fucking tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On May 7th, I interviewed Kevin Zeis, who was, along with many others, inside the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., protecting it for the Venezuelans from an illegal takeover by the self-appointed and U.S. government-backed fake president Juan Guaido's supporters. On May 16th, the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. was invaded by the U.S., and Kevin and all inside were arrested. Kevin is with me again today to update us on the evolving events concerning the Venezuelan embassy and the U.S. government's attempted coup in Venezuela. Kevin Zeis is co-coordinator of PopularResistance.org and It's Our Economy, an organization that advocates for democratizing the economy. He's also an attorney who is one of the original organizers of the National Occupation of Washington, D.C. He has been active in independent and third-party political campaigns, including for state legislative offices in Maryland, governor of California, and U.S. president, where he served as press secretary and spokesperson for Ralph Nader in 2004. He ran for the Senate in 2006. Kevin Zeis, welcome to the show.
Happy to be on it. Thank you for inviting me.
On May 16th, you and a few others were arrested and removed from the Venezuelan embassy, where you had been since April 10th as part of the Embassy Protection Collective.
Right.
And can you please, for people who may not know about this, can you give a brief summary of why you were in the embassy in the first place, and then we'll get to your arrest?
Sure. The United States has been working with a group of pro-coup people to try to force a regime change in Venezuela against the democratically elected president, Nicolas Maduro. They have failed in Venezuela, and so they've been moving their efforts to Washington, D.C. and the United States. They gave the military attaché building to the pro-coup people, as well as the diplomatic offices in New York at the U.N., and so when we heard that, we talked to the Venezuelan embassy people, developed a relationship with them, and they gave us permission to stay in the embassy to protect it, to serve as interim protectors while a mutual interim protecting agreement could be reached between the U.S. and Venezuela. So the U.S. embassy in Venezuela could be protected, and the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. could be protected by third countries. This essentially was U.S. citizens going into a foreign embassy in Washington, D.C. to stop a U.S. coup.
You and I did a previous interview on May 7th, and later, after that, the water and electricity was cut off. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Well, the opposition was working with the State Department and the Secret Service to try to frighten us out of the embassy. And they first off blocked food coming in. People who tried to bring food were assaulted. When that didn't work, they then turned off the electricity, the U.S. government did. Got the TEPCO utility to turn off the electricity, and then our water was turned off. And so we had expected that. We were prepared for that. We had gathered a lot of water in every container we could find. Every trash can was lined with plastic and filled with water, so we had lots of water stored, and we're carefully using it. We also had developed a good storage of food. There have been multiple attempts by our allies outside to get food in, and we had developed a good storage of food. We rationed ourselves to two small meals a day so that it could last. And, you know, we stayed. Some people left. We had over 50 people in the embassy sweeping at the beginning. We got down to 7. We had like 15 and cut it in half to 7 in order to make our supplies, our food and water last longer. And those 7 stayed up until the threat of arrest. 3 independent media people that were embedded in the embassy left before the arrest came, and we stayed beyond that. And the arrest threats were made. The first time they came to remove us, they cut the chains on the front door, opened the door, and we had about a 45-minute conversation with the police. We warned them that crossing that threshold would be a violation of international law, violating the Vienna Convention, and that could lead to U.S. embassies around the world being under threat and insecure, as well as injuries to U.S. personnel in U.S. embassies, and that it could lead to militarism, escalation of tensions between the U.S. and Venezuela that could lead to war with Russia and China siding with Venezuela. That could lead to a global conflict. And so we really warned them that crossing that threshold was a major error and a major step, and we urged them to reconsider. After 45 minutes, they turned around and left. And so we were like, didn't expect that, but we went outside to the window and let our allies know we were still there. Everyone was very pleased. And then 3 days later, the police came and forcibly entered the embassy to arrest us.
And could you tell us the details of the actual arrest?
Well, there were more than 100 paramilitary police who came to the embassy. They sought to break the door down. They didn't have, unlike us, we had a key, so we didn't unlawfully enter. They didn't have a key, so they used a battering ram to break a door down. They came into the embassy. We let them know we were on the second floor in the conference room. We said we're on the second floor. We shouted them so they could come find us. We were not resisting. And there were about 17 people in the conference room, law enforcement people in the conference room with the four of us. We'd always made it clear that we would not barricade ourselves in or resist arrest in any kind of violent way. And so when they came in to see us, we let them know that we were not going to be violent and that if they were going to arrest us, we were not going to resist that arrest. So they searched us, they patted us down, checked our groins, put us in handcuffs, and carried us out. They could have, that was at 8 o'clock in the morning, they just finished breakfast. They could have actually gotten us to a magistrate that day, but they took their time, went very slowly to make sure that we got a night in jail. We spent a night in jail. We went to the court the next day, a federal magistrate, the same magistrate who signed the order allowing the break-in to arrest us, then decided on our conditions of release. We were given personal recognizance release. No bail was required. We're required to call in once a week to let them know we're still in D.C. We're required to let them know if we want to travel. And we're required to stay 100 feet from Venezuelan embassy properties. And we've done that. We've gone to Venezuelan embassy twice since we were released, both times just over 100 feet away, and helped to participate in protests and marches from the embassy to the White House, taking up the streets of Washington, D.C. to further this effort. And so the effort continues to be ongoing, even though we're not in the embassy. We still consider ourselves embassy protectors.
And I understand you have a court date on June 12th. What were the charges against you, and what do you expect to happen?
Yeah, the charges against us were strange. They couldn't charge us with trespass or unlawful entry since we were there with the permission of the elected government, and they had given us a key, so we didn't unlawfully enter or trespass. They had to come up with something else, and it was a charge none of us, including our lawyers, had ever seen. I'm a lawyer as well. It was a charge that claimed that we were preventing the protection of the embassy. It's kind of amusing since we were actually serving as embassy protectors for the legitimate government of Venezuela. And so the next hearing is what's called a status conference. It's the initial hearing where our jurors will be signed on. Our lawyers will sign on to represent us, and we will decide the next phases. We will start to proceed on discovery and move toward trial. We see these charges as bogus charges. We look forward to defending them. So there are misdemeanor charges, only up to a year in jail. We expect that we will be found not guilty when this is pursued.
Can you tell us, I know you said that the effort is still ongoing. Can you tell us what's happening? Is there daily demonstrations, or what's it like there?
Right. Well, we initially had, the day after we were arrested, we came to the embassy and joined with about 500 or so other people. And there was a rally at the embassy. And we marched from the embassy through Georgetown, along M Street, down Pennsylvania Avenue, to the White House, where we held a rally at the White House, where we called for escalation of efforts to protect the embassy and end the coup and the economic war against Venezuela. The next day, Jesse Jackson came to the embassy and held an event with us. We joined with him in calling for a revived peace movement that is crosses all sorts of cultural, racial, gender, and class barriers, and is not just focused on Venezuela, but all of U.S. militarism. And we've met now with members of other organizations that are part of the Embassy Protection Collective, as well as individuals, to discuss next steps. And we are planning a series of actions, both national days of action, international days of action, calling for an end to the U.S. coup, an end to the economic war, and a mutual protecting power agreement for the U.S. Embassy in Caracas and the the Venezuelan Embassy in Washington, D.C. And we're going to culminate on September 21st. That's the tentative date. We're making sure that permits are possible for that day. At the United Nations, when the General Assembly meets, that's the International Day of Peace, September 21st. And we'll be calling on foreign ministers and heads of state to speak out against U.S. militarism, the U.S. sanctions against various countries, which are illegal under international law, and we'll be calling for restoring international law, the Vienna Convention, and the Mutual Protecting Power Agreement at the embassy. So we're out of the embassy, but we're escalating our actions. I have no doubt that we are going to escalate these actions to the point where this movement is going to grow, and no candidate in the 2020 election is going to be able to publicly support this coup. This coup has failed in Venezuela. It will fail in the United States as well. The opposition that supports this coup will regret that we were forced out of the embassy, because on the outside, we can actually do more to build the movement against U.S. imperialism and U.S. empire. This will be a turning point in the history of U.S. empire. It will be an example of another coup failure, and we need to build a national consensus that opposes future U.S. regime change efforts and regime change coups, because they have been disasters from the start. A lot of these are based on the Iranian coup in 1953 against Mohammad Mossadegh, the elected president of, excuse me, the elected prime minister of Iran, who was going to do some great things for that country. He wanted to use the oil wealth of that country to lift his people up. He would have shown that democracy works in the Middle East. It would have had a major positive effect for the future of the Middle East. Instead, the U.S. coup brought in a authoritarian dictator, the Shah of Iran, whose secret police tortured and imprisoned people. They suppressed the Muslim religion, and it has led to disaster in the Middle East. A lot of the problems we see in the never-ending wars in the Middle East today would not have occurred if that U.S. coup in 1953 had not happened. And so I think it's time for the people of the United States to say no more U.S. coups. U.S. should not be intervening and forcing governments to put in place governments that oppose what the people want in those countries. We want self-determination for countries in our world. We want Venezuela, which declared its independence in 1998 when it elected Hugo Chavez. We want their independence respected. We want their dignity respected. We want the United States to negotiate with Venezuela to purchase oil, not seek regime change to steal oil. It's time for change in foreign policy, and that's what we hope this Embassy Protection Collective begins the process of developing.
Yes, and currently what's happening at the embassy? Is it empty, or did the Guaido people take it over? What's happening there?
It's currently empty. The Secret Service has put up wards around the first floor window so you can't be broken into. It was broken into three times when we were in the embassy, and none of the people who broke in were ever prosecuted, which was one example of many of how the state Secret Service allowed this to get out of hand and out of control. So right now it's boarded up and vacant. Yesterday, the fictional ambassador, Carlos Vecchio, had a low-level meeting with State Department officials. They had planned a much higher-level meeting, but the U.S. reduced it to a low-level meeting. We hope this is a sign that the United States is coming to its senses, realizes that the Guaido coup has been lost, and does not hand the embassy over to Carlos Vecchio, the fictional ambassador of a failed coup. If it does get handed over, there will be protests if it does get handed over to Guaido's forces. And so we hope that doesn't happen. We're still continuing to work for a protecting power agreement. That's what we want to see as the resolution, and we're doing all we can to make that happen. But so far, it's vacant.
And the opposition that was outside protesting and camping out while you were there, you know, occupying the embassy, I was looking at some of these people, and I know some of them had connections to Raytheon. They were marketing firms. I don't know if you want to speak a little bit about who these opposition people were.
Yes, there's no question. There's an excellent article in Mint Press News by Alex Rubenstein that we published on Popular Resistance as well, which describes the opposition, at least some of the people in the opposition. These are basically people who have left Venezuela Carlos Vecchio, for example, the fictional ambassador, fled Venezuela because if he was back in Venezuela, he'd be arrested and incarcerated for the violence that he helped to create and cause more than 140 deaths. But many of these people are out there for their own personal profit. They're tied to the military-industrial complex, to U.S. intelligence, and to profit-making off of Venezuela's resources. They've hired professional PR firms in order to try to change their image because the people who are outside show themselves who they were. These were racist, misogynist, violent people. Our black members of our collective were, made fun of as apes by these people and shown bananas. Women were threatened with sexual assault. People who tried to bring food or even toothbrushes and toothpaste to the embassy were assaulted, and the Secret Service allowed that to happen. In fact, very often the Secret Service would arrest the people assaulted rather than the people who actually did the assaulting. And so this is a violent group outside with personal financial interests tied to a coup, and that really indicates what this was really about. This was about raping Venezuela of its immense natural resources. Not only is it number one in oil reserves, it's number one in diamond and gold, number five in gas reserves. It also has vast quantities of reserves and minerals that are used for electronics, telephones, computers, as well as for weapons. And so this is what the U.S. really wants, is a puppet government put in place, and Guaido is a puppet for sure. He was a nobody politician who no one ever heard of that was selected by the United States. They want to put a puppet government in place who will provide the United States with access to those resources so our corporations can profit and our war machine can continue to wreak havoc around the world. The people of Venezuela are resisting, and the same tactics used against the people of Venezuela as far as electric attacks, attacks on their food supply, attacks on their economy, attacks on their water. We saw the same attacks in a smaller level against the Venezuelan embassy. When those attacks were made, it brought us into greater unity amongst ourselves, with our allies outside, as well as with the Venezuelan people. And we see ourselves as acting in solidarity with the people of Venezuela who are resisting this U.S. coup.
And how did the Venezuelan government react to you all being arrested and removed from the embassy?
They have applauded our efforts, including the foreign minister, the deputy vice minister, the president of the country, President Maduro, have all responded with outrage over the U.S. invasion of their embassy, and it was an invasion. This is 100 paramilitary police using a battering ram to break into the embassy in violation of the Vienna Convention. They have spoken out against that. President Maduro has said they will take this to all diplomatic levels. I hope that means challenging this in the International Court of Justice, because I suspect that that court would rule against the United States for this action. And so we've had very positive responses from the government of Venezuela, and we were really pleased when the people of Venezuela held a day of solidarity in support of our embassy protection collective. They held a mass rally in March mentioning each of our names. In fact, this occurred the day before we were attacked by the 100 paramilitary police who seized the embassy illegally. So the support from Venezuela, government and people, has been very heartening.
And I know we had mentioned this before in our last interview, but I think it bears repeating, the media coverage of what was happening. I saw nothing about this in any of the mainstream media outlets about what was happening at the Venezuelan embassy. I don't know if you want to speak to that again.
Yeah, I mean, the media did cover that we were arrested. That was the first time a lot of media ever covered it. You know, this event should have been national news. Really, CNN and MSNBC and even Fox should have been out there every day covering 37 days of a unique event in U.S. history. There's never been before a time has it occurred where U.S. citizens have gone into a foreign embassy in Washington, D.C. to protect that embassy from a U.S. coup. That is an unusual event and deserved coverage. The reason why they couldn't cover it was because the U.S. media has been lying about Venezuela. And in order to cover why we were in there, they'd have to cover our side of the story. If people go to popularresistance.org and read the declaration of the Embassy Protection Collective, they'll understand that President Maduro was legally elected. He met all the levels of requirements of a democratic election, according to more than 150 international election observers who unanimously say the election was legitimate, democratic, without fraud, and Maduro is the president. And they also have to look at the in the declaration how we described how Guaido's self-appointment violated the Venezuelan constitution in multiple ways. And they'd have to cover the Vienna Convention and how the U.S. is not allowed to enter the Vienna Convention and is required to protect it and was doing the opposite. So all of these realities are the opposite of what the U.S. media has been reporting. And so covering our protection of the embassy would require our story to be told, and that would mean that the lies of the corporate media would have been exposed. It would also have meant that people in the United States would hear the truth about Venezuela. People will oppose U.S. military action. They'll oppose U.S. coup action, and they will support our effort to protect the embassy. So our protests would have grown even larger. As it was, we had people outside the embassy every day, some sleeping outside in sleeping bags. Every day they were out there supporting us. There were people outside who found ways to get food in. We had a very good storage of food as a result of their efforts, and we had people in Venezuela showing their support. So even without corporate media coverage, the independent media, the foreign media, especially Latin American media, and the social media of people being the media, got the message out. So that our effort was growing and getting momentum. When Jesse Jackson came the day before the invasion of the embassy, his being there brought some media attention. And then when he was able to participate in getting some food into the embassy, creating an amazing video of the opposition coup supporters trying to grab food out of Jesse Jackson's hand and prevent us from pulling it up by rope to the second floor. Amazing images of our former vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, Ajamu Baraka, helping to get that food in along with other members of the Black Alliance for Peace and Code Pink and other groups. And as that video footage was going to go viral. And so the State Department realized they had better stop this now. Now they knew we had a food for at least another month. They knew that we were going to stay, and they knew that media was beginning to break through. And so I think that was a key issue for the State Department making this mistaken decision to violate the Vienna Convention and violently enter the Venezuelan embassy.
And do you see, because they actually violated international law in doing that, do you see any kind of counter-suing or taking them to court for these violations?
Well, at this stage, we're focused on the criminal defense, and we're not really thinking about civil suits. We're glad to see President Maduro say that they are going to go to the highest levels of international courts, and I hope that happens. The International Court of Justice, I think, is very important. We are going to focus on the criminal defense of this case first. We're going to engage in discovery to gather information in preparation for that defense, and I think we'll, in the end, have be found not guilty, and we do have a right to a jury trial in this case because the punishment is severe enough that that is required by law. And so we expect a jury to consider this case, rule in our favor, and that will be another example of the U.S. coup failing in Venezuela and now being repudiated by a jury in Washington, D.C. That's what we hope the outcome will be.
Now, you had mentioned about all the actions that are going on, and then you're going to build up to the September 21st event at the UN in New York. How do people, if they want to get involved, where can they go to learn about this and to get involved?
Yeah, well, we are covering this every day on popularresistance.org. Each of the organizations that are part of the collective are doing that. So if you go to popularresistance.org, you can sign up for our daily news service, which is a great way to stay on top of news, not just on Venezuela, but about movements around the world and in the United States. It's a summary of about 10 to 15 articles, about a paragraph each, and you can click on the article for more information if you want more information about a specific article. We'll be having updates on popular resistance and in that daily news summary. We also do a weekly news analysis, our newsletter. You can sign up for that as well. That comes out each weekend and talks about some hot issue or key issue in movement work. And so this is our site is a place for staying up to date on what movements are doing and how you can get involved in various fronts of struggle, including the Venezuelan struggle.
You were in the embassy for like 36 days, I think it was, and you had no food or a shortage of food, low on water, no electricity. How are you feeling about all of that?
We're feeling very good about it. We went on April 10th. We started the Embassy Protection Collective April 10th. It was fine up until we were actually held forums every night. We would go in and out, go out to restaurants, bring food in. There was no problem until the April 30th coup attempt by Guaido, which failed. On that day, we started to see these pro-coup advocates showing up and the Secret Service allowing them to put tents up around the embassy and threaten us, break and enter, assault our allies. We saw that violence occur from April 30th on, and we had people sleeping in the garage because they had broken in the garage three times. We had people sleeping in the sea level, which is the ground level, basement level floors where windows were, because we had two people break in to that level. And so it was a great deal of insecurity in addition to the food and water and electricity. So it was a tense thing, but we, as I said, we really felt we were getting a small taste of what the people of Venezuela are getting from the U.S. economic war and U.S. threats of militarism and attacks on the electrical system. So that just gave us greater solidarity, and we really got stronger in our view of staying. We shrunk down from more than 50 people staying to four for various reasons, people's personal lives, health issues, family issues, work issues, as well as the threats from the outside. We got down to 14 people when the water was turned off. We realized we had to be cautious, and we cut our numbers to seven in order to make sure we could stay longer. When the U.S. tried to come in the first time, three people, our embedded media, left voluntarily, and we were down to four people who were ready to stay for a month or two or whatever it took. We were ready. We were even talking about fasting if necessary. Well, fasting was a long way off. We never had to fast. We were eating two meals a day, restricted diets, restricted water intake, but we're healthy, and you know, we're ready to stay for a long time. And I think that the government began to realize, we told the government when they came in the first time that they would have to carry us out on stretchers because we would fast if that was necessary. And I think they started to understand that we were serious about that and realized that if they wanted this to end, they were going to have to come in and arrest us, even if it meant an illegal arrest and a violation of international law. A violation of law that puts U.S. embassies around the world at risk, because if the Vienna Convention does not apply in Washington, D.C., why should it apply anywhere in the world?
Right.
And U.S. embassies and U.S. personnel should be at risk now.
Well, Kevin, I really applaud all of your efforts, you and all the people who are doing this with you. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like the listeners to know?
Just people should know that they can have a big difference here. You know, it's just a handful of us who made this happen. People need to not be afraid. They should go where they're not supposed to go, say what they're not supposed to say, and refuse to leave when they're told to leave. And do it as part of a campaign with other people and organizations so you can build it into an effective event. I think there's a lot of lessons for potential impact individuals can have in this, and people should feel strengthened by it and feel have courage to take the actions necessary to root out these injustices.
Great. Well, again, thank you very much for all your efforts and for your 36 days in the embassy. And I will ask you to do another interview as things move forward. So thank
you. That sounds great.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you a lot. Bye-bye.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with activist Kevin Zeis, who was arrested along with three others on March 16th for legally occupying the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. for 36 days with the permission of the legitimate and democratically elected Venezuelan government. To learn more about all of this, you can go to the website popularresistance.org or the website mintpressnews.com. And I also want to remind you that the Red Pill Expo will be in Hartford on June 7th through 9th. For more information, you can go to redpillexpo.org. And architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, will be speaking here at the University of Hartford on Sunday, June 9th at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium. And again, that's Sunday, June 9th at 7 p.m. And the event will be called Prosecuting 9/11, Scientific Evidence as the Foundation. Learn why Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is suing the FBI over explosive World Trade Center evidence, and why the U.S. attorney has agreed to impanel a grand jury. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.